this time to make things different. I'm remembering to turn on the recorder at the beginning of the talk. All right, I wanted to continue to discuss the sort of statistics we've been doing, the first chapter you read, and then go on to start on multivariable statistics. But first, at one of the suggestion of one of you, I put up some homework problems, not to be handed in, but to be done. How many of you actually noticed them and looked at them? All right, they are there. You are now on notice that they are there, and I was going to discuss them today if everybody looked at them, but since you had no way of knowing they were there unless you happened to look at the syllabus, I figured I would probably discuss them Thursday. As I just mentioned, at someone's suggestion, I put up a couple of not-to-be-handed-in homework problems on the syllabus on the website, and since nobody knew about them, we won't be discussing them today, but we can discuss them on Thursday. All right, let me start by talking about the normal distribution and ways you use that and ways it's relevant. And could you get a little bit closer? My voice is still pretty weak, although it's gradually recovering, and I'm trying to treat it as gently as possible in the hopes of continued improvement. Thank you. And I'm also forming the conjecture that class goes a little better when people are closer. I'm not quite sure why, but... this is hot water, actually. It's not too bad, but it's much more easily available. It comes out of the tap. All right, the bell curve or normal distribution. If people understand what I mean by a distribution, I'm talking about, if you say heights, how many people are 6 feet, how many are fewer people are 6 feet one, still fewer 6 feet two, also fewer 5'8", and so forth. And you can imagine graphing sort of for each inch interval how many people are in that interval. And the normal distribution, as we'll be seeing in a little, has not only the characteristic that many, though by no means all, real-world phenomena come close to it, but it turns out that if you take a non-normal distribution and you look at averages, you say, let's pick 10 people and measure their heights, then pick another 10 people and measure their heights, each time take the average. The averages tend to be closer to a normal distribution than the observations are. And the bigger the sample size, the closer that's true. So that there are quite a lot of cases in which it makes sense to say, even though the distribution probably isn't normal, what we're looking at is the distribution of the average of a sample of 100, and that's probably close. So that's part of the reason it's useful. If anyone is curious, I'm sure you can find the mathematical form of the normal distribution on the web with no trouble at all. It's an e to the minus x squared, basically. And one useful thing once you have a normal distribution is you can simply look up on a table how many people are any given distance from the mean. That's what the Z table tells you. So the way you do it, and we'll be doing a couple of examples in a few minutes, is you say this distance from the mean is how many standard deviations. Right? In effect, the normal distribution is simply defined by where its mean is and how wide it is. Once you've got that, you've got everything. Because the total size, the height of it, is constrained by the fact that if you sum up the probability of all heights, what do you get? What's the sum of the probability that somebody is between 0 and 1 inch, plus the probability that someone's between 1 and 2, and so forth, all the way up to between 100 feet and 100 feet 1 inch? What is this? Which is 1, right? 100% is the same as the number 1, right? So therefore, the area of the normal of your normal curve has to be 1. That the area shows summed probabilities for all of the things. So that gives you enough of a constraint so that once you know its center and its width, you know the whole curve. And you then look up on a Z table, and the Z table tells you how many observations will be more than 2 standard deviations above the mean, how many will be more than 3. Actually, it does the other way around. It tells you how many are less than 2, how many are less than 3. But if you know that 0.98 are less than 2, then you know that 0.02 are more than 2, right? Because the total, again, is 1. So that's all fairly simple. And I'm sort of going over it in so much detail because I have this not wholly baseless prejudice that law students are less likely to be good at mathematics than students in some other fields. And so you're obviously not a random sample of law students, which could get into a different statistical point. So, for example, the example I gave, if you know that your kid has an IQ of 150, which is a respectable IQ. That's a little over 3 standard deviations above the mean, and you can look it up and discover that it's something better than 1 in 100, if I remember correctly. I can look it up anyway. And the textbook has a Z-table available. The central limit theorem is what I was referring to before when I said that the distribution of the mean tends to be closer to the normal than the distribution of the actual observations. And it turns out that it tells us something else, several things. It tells us first, if you take a random sample from a distribution, the mean of the sample is an unbiased estimate of the mean of the distribution. By an unbiased estimate, we mean not that it's going to be the same, because of course, if your sample is fewer than everybody, it's not going to be exactly right, but that on average it'll be the same. So if you imagine we want to know people's heights and the real average height is 69 inches, take 10 people, measure their height, 67 inches. Take 10 people, measure their height, 71 inches, take and so forth. If you keep doing that, you're going to tend to get just about the average. And it also is true that the unbiased estimate means not that it's exactly right, but that it'll average to be right. And if you want the standard deviation for heights, if you take a sample of 100 people and you say, what's the standard deviation from its means of that sample? The sample has some mean. You don't know the mean of the distribution usually. And you can calculate a standard deviation just for the set of 100 people you look at. And that will give you an estimate of the standard deviation for the whole distribution, except, as I discussed before, since for any sample, if the elements in the sample are on average a little high, their mean is a little high too, and so their deviation from the mean is going to look smaller than it really is, it turns out that you can compensate that. If when you're doing the averaging for the standard deviation, you divide by one less than the number of observations. So if you have a sample of 100, you calculate the standard deviation, except that when you come to the stage where you've summed up all the deviations and you're now averaging them, you divide by 99 instead of by 100. Does that make sense? I'm not telling you why that's true, because I can't prove it, but well, I probably have seen a proof at some point. But do people understand what just as a simple rule of thumb, and it usually doesn't matter, obviously, if you're talking about large samples, the difference between dividing between 99 and dividing by 100 isn't important, but if you imagine a sample of 4 or 5 or 6, it does become significant. And as I pointed out, with a sample size of 1, if you naively calculated the standard deviation, you would say, obviously, the standard deviation of heights is 0. This one's height is exactly its average, and that's the extreme case of just that problem. It turns out, interestingly enough, that if you take a bunch of samples of size n, say, pick 100 people at random and measure their heights, the standard deviation of the averages of those is 1 over the square root of n times the standard deviation of a single observation. So if it were the case that if you picked individuals out of the population, looked at how their height compared to the average, and calculated standard deviation, suppose the answer would be 3 inches. It then turns out that if you picked a sample of 100 and took the mean of that sample, that's going to be much closer that's going to have much less random variation than a single sample. All right, it's going to average out. And indeed, we know exactly how much less its standard deviation will be a tenth as high. The standard deviation of the mean of a sample of n is 1 over the square root of n times the standard deviation of a single observation. Does that make sense, or is it all double talk? Gobbledygook. Anybody? Any brave person willing to say it's gobbledygook?
I don't know. It's a little confusing to me.
All right, fine. Suppose we pick people at random and look at their height. We expect let's imagine that in fact this is the average height, which we don't know, but it's kind of the same. And we pick somebody and his height is here. Pick someone and he's here. Someone's here. Someone's here. These heights are this is the only difference. Just dots. Now suppose instead of picking into so you could calculate on average how far they are from the mean. And you actually do it by taking the difference, squaring it, summing it, averaging it, and taking the square root of that, which is sort of complicated. But basically it's just a measure of on average how far they are. Alternatively, instead of doing that, you could say, well, let's take 4 people chosen at random, find their average height, which is here. Let's take another 4 people, let's say
those four, your average height, that's there. How about another four? How about those four? Your average height is there. You would find that these dots cluster more tightly than the individual dots. Because on average, any one of these, this is one that's way above average height, but it's rather unlikely that you'll get four people, all of whom are way above average height. So the pattern is that the larger the size of the sample you're taking the mean of, the tighter the cluster of the means.
Makes sense? Yeah, that makes sense.
So let's try this for a very simple numerical example, which is we have a population of something. I don't know what it is, but it's something where we're guessing that maybe the population mean is 10. Suppose the question is we're looking at kids in, what would it be, about fourth grade, roughly, is when you're 10, and someone says, I believe that this is a perfectly nice average school. I believe the kid's average age ought to be 10. And you say, well, we happen to know that the average age of kids in fourth grade is 10. Let's pick 16 of the kids in this particular school and see what their average age is. And turns out to be 8. All right? Beginning to wonder, maybe these are very bright kids, there's something odd going on. What's the standard deviation? Well, with our sample of 16 kids, we can calculate a standard deviation from that sample. That standard deviation is an estimate of the standard deviation for the whole population. That's all it is. And it turns out to be 2. All right, this isn't very plausible for age of kids in school, unless it's a very odd school. But maybe it is. Some of the kids are 8, some of them are 10, a few of them are 11, some of them are 9, some of them are 6, and so forth. The question is, if all that's happening is that there's a random distribution of kids, standard deviation 2, mean 10, how likely is it that when you pick 16, their average will be 8? Well, the answer is that if the standard deviation for an observation is 2, the standard deviation for the mean of 16 observations is 1/2. Because the square root of 16 is 4, and that's 2 divided by 4. All right? Make sense? So, in this case, since the deviation between the mean of our sample and what we are guessing is the mean of the population is 2, that's 4 standard deviations, 4 standard deviations of the mean. It is extremely unlikely that your sample mean would be 4 standard deviations away from the distribution mean, and you could look it up in the z-table, but it's probably 1 in 1,000 kind of odds, roughly. So that's one example where you're using this method, and it's just worth remembering that the relevant standard deviation is not 2, that the 2 would be relevant if what you were saying, we've picked one kid, is he really a random kid, or is this, you know, the teacher we got by mistake or something? And if you picked one kid, and the kid turned out to be 8, you would say, well, standard deviation is 2, mean, we're guessing, is 10. Isn't astonishing if there are a few 8-year-olds there. But it would be very astonishing when you picked 16 at random, they were on average 8. Yes, you got a question? No. All right. Here's an example of doing the same thing on a somewhat larger scale. Let us suppose the question is, what's the average rent paid by SCU law students? And suppose, for some reason, somebody has conjectured that it's about $1,000, and you want to know if it's likely that it's, how likely it is that it's true. You'd like to know that. So you take a sample of 100 people, I think that's what I'm assuming here, yeah, a sample of 100 law students, find out what rent each one is paying, and you then do two things. You calculate the mean of the sample, and you calculate the standard deviation from the sample, which is your estimate of the standard deviation for all law students. And again, you divide by 99, not by 100, when you're doing the averaging part to allow for the fact that's a little off. And we then have an estimate of the standard deviation of the population of how much individual law students vary in their rent. And suppose, I think I've got a number right here. No, I don't. It's sigma, whatever sigma turns out to be. We then say, all right, our sample is 100, so the standard deviation for a mean of 100 observations ought to be about a tenth sigma. All right, dividing by the square root of 100. Got the mechanics of that? We would then take what we observed the average to be, minus 1,000, which is what our conjecture. We would say how many standard deviations, divide that by sigma over 10, and then look at the z-table. All right, do I actually do it? Yes, here we are. Hypothesis is average rent is 100, sample size is 100. For those 100 students, their average rent is 950. Sigma is 150. That is, if we look at individual law students, that's the standard deviation of how much their rents vary. That means that sigma over the square root of 100 is going to be 15, because that's the standard deviation of the mean of 100 observations. That with that 15, the with $950 as the rent, which is $50 below our guess at the average rent, that's 3 1/3 standard deviations below. So we then want to use the z-table. Now at this point, we have to think about the difference between a one-tailed test and a two-tailed test. The one-tailed test would occur if the conjecture you were testing was that rents were more than 1,000. The two-tailed is that they're different from 1,000, so you count either more or less as evidence. And the question then is, how good is this evidence? So you work out the sum of the probability that it is either 3.33 standard deviations below the mean or 3.33 standard deviations above the mean. That turns out to be about 0.01. That is, the probability that will be between those two numbers is 0.99, so the probability outside is 0.01. So that means that the chance that if it was really $1,000, you would have gotten the results you got, results as far off that as you got, is only about 1 in 100. All right, so that's sort of a standard kind of statistical calculation of the sort that's used to give confidence results. So what does this tell us? It tells us that if the average rent is 1,000, there's only one chance in 100 that a sample of 100 rents would have a mean that was at least $50 higher or lower, which is what's normally described as a 0.01 significance level. That doesn't mean that the probability that the rent is actually $1,000 is 0.01. Right? In fact, what would you guess the odds are that the rent is exactly, the average rent of all law students here is exactly $1,000?
Zero chance.
Very close to zero. And I can say that without even knowing what rents are.
Right.
Even if it's somewhere around there, it could be 1,000, it could be 1,001, it could be 1,001 and 10 cents, it could be, right. So that's quite unlikely. So what we're having a measure of how strong this evidence is against something, which isn't the same thing as a measure of how likely something is to be true. But it also, although it's strong evidence that it's not 1,000, it's not by itself strong evidence that it's far from 1,000. Because the significance is a statement of how sure you are there's a deviation, not of how big the deviation is. So that suppose that instead of looking at 100 law students, we were looking at 10,000 people in San Jose. Suppose our conjecture was an average rent of $800. If the average of our 10,000 was 802, that would be very strong evidence that it wasn't 800, because with that big a sample, you're going to have very small standard deviations. But it would still be a tiny deviation from the conjecture. So it's always worth paying attention to the difference between the confidence level, which tells you how sure something is happening, and the size of the effect, which tells you how big it is. And you could have a large effect with a very low confidence level. For example, suppose we picked two law students, and it turned out that these are the two richest students in the school, due to that $60K that you're getting as an advance payment from your employer-to-be, and that each of them is paying $3,000 a month in rent. All right, that would be a huge deviation from 1,000, but it probably wouldn't be significant, because given, at least if there's a sizable standard deviation with a sample size as small as 2, you would expect sizable deviations. All right, maybe not that sizable. But, right. So the basic logic of confidence results, which you'll see a lot of when statistics is used in law cases, is you have a null hypothesis. For example, the simple one you use all the time as an example is, this is a fair coin. You have an experiment, say the result of flipping the coin 10 times and getting 7 heads. You want to decide if the null hypothesis is true, and implicitly you have some alternative hypothesis. And implicitly, because that tells you what directions of evidence count as evidence against truth. So that if I'm trying to argue that men are taller than women, for example, average height of the men in a group being higher than the average height of women is evidence for. Average height of the men being lower is not evidence for, even though it's inconsistent with the claim that they're the same height. All right. Again, one-tailed versus two-tailed test. And the standard question you're asking is, if the null hypothesis is true, if this is a fair coin, how likely is the result to be at least as far as I observe from what it predicts? Just as we were asking before, if the average rent is really $1,000, how likely is it that the average of 100 students would turn out to be only $950? People see the form of the question you're asking? And if the answer is, if the coin is fair, the chance of being this far from five heads, five tails is only 0.05, then we say the null hypothesis has been rejected at the 0.05 level. That's the way confidence results are reported. To restate it, and I'm saying the same thing over and over, people so often get it wrong that I'm going to do it, that the confidence level tells you how strong this piece of evidence against the null hypothesis is. It does not tell you how likely the null hypothesis is to be true. Just as you might say that we've discovered that witness identifications are wrong only one time in four, but after we've proved that the person they say committed the crime was actually 1,000 miles away at the time, the probability that he's guilty is a whole lot less than 3/4. Right? So in effect, what the experiment is doing is telling you how to modify whatever other evidence you have on the basis of the experiment. I'll get to that a little bit later. And the second point I've made before is that statistically significant doesn't mean it's an important or large effect. It means an effect unlikely to occur by chance. So if I take a coin and flip it 10,000 times, if it's even a tiny bit off 50-50, I'm going to end up with a significant evidence that it's not a fair coin, even though that might be evidence it's only 0.501 versus 0.499. All right? Make sense? Yeah.
So when you reject that, in that case right there, you reject the null hypothesis, right?
I would reject the null hypothesis.
So the ultimate conclusion is you wouldn't just say the coin then is unfair.
I would say the coin is unfair, okay. But that would be a little misleading because I would say it looks as though it's not very unfair.
Okay.
But if all I reported was significance, you wouldn't know whether I had flipped it 10,000 times and it turned out to be a tiny bit off, or I flipped it 8 times and it turned out to be 8 heads. Those would both be very significant results, but they'd have very different implications. If you think about, again, the law case, if you say, how sure are we that your product causes cancer? Oh, the chance is only 1 in 100 that the result is accidental. How big is the effect? Chance of getting cancer goes up from 1 in 1,000,000 to 1.001 in 1,000,000. All right, those could both be true if you had big enough sample sizes. All of what I'm talking about now is what's called sampling error, the variation that occurs because you're taking only a subset of the whole population and therefore just random chance. But notice that there are other forms of errors which are often more important, which means that talking about the sampling error, which has the great virtue that you can calculate it, as if it was the whole error, can be very, very misleading. So the obvious example, especially in at this university with our Innocence Project, is DNA tests. That it's sort of pretty standard, I gather, for the prosecution to say the chance that the defendant's DNA would match the DNA found at the crime scene by chance was less than 1 in 10,000,000. So you've got to convict him. And of course, the statement is false. The statement is probably a correct statistical statement, but it is ignoring the fact that the chance that the policeman confused two samples from the defendant with a sample of the defendant and a sample from the crime scene, although it isn't very high, is a whole lot higher than 1 in 100,000,000. The chance that the policeman is lying that the policeman is himself convinced that the defendant is guilty and has therefore deliberately faked the evidence is much higher than 100 million. The chance that the lab is incompetent, that the lab knows that when they get two samples, they're supposed to match because that's what the police department likes, and they're really just sort of going through the motions. A real case in, I think, Texas that turned up a few years ago. Again, it's not very high, but it's way higher than 100 million, 100 million. So you want to think about the rate of sampling error as a lower bound to your error, not as all of the error, especially when this guy on the other side of the case is trying to pretend that sampling error is really all there is. All right, let me do something which I don't think the book discusses, but which I think is worth discussing because it's actually the right way of thinking about these questions in my and many other people's opinion. And this is what's called Bayesian statistics. And this has to do with, again, my coin flipping experiment. And given that the result, as described, doesn't tell us how likely it is to be a double-headed coin, how would we find out how likely it was? And in this case, the null hypothesis is that it's a fair coin. The alternative is that it's a double-headed coin. So every time we flip it and gets heads, we've got stronger evidence for the alternative hypothesis. If we ever get tails, we're finished because that would eliminate the alternative hypothesis. And we flip it twice and get two heads. The chance that the evidence for the alternative hypothesis is that strong is only 1 in 4. There's only one chance in 4 that you'll get two heads with a fair coin. But that doesn't mean that it's got 3 chances out of 4 of being double-headed. And the way to think about it is to start out with how many coins we think are double-headed. So suppose we've actually, separately from this experiment, looked at lots of coins, and we've discovered that in the population of coins circulating in San Jose, where it happens that there was an enterprising forger who wasn't very competent going for a while, that one coin in 1,000 is double-headed. It's an awfully high number, but let's use it for convenience. So when I pull a coin at random from my pocket, before we flip it at all, the chance that it's double-headed is 1 in 1,000. All right? What is the chance that it both is double-headed and when I flip it twice I get two heads? What's the chance of that sequence of events?
1 in 4,000.
Really? What's the odds when you flip a double-headed coin of getting heads? When you flip a double-headed coin twice, what are the odds of getting heads both times? So what are the chances that if I pull a coin from my pocket and flip it twice and get heads both times, what are the chances of getting that result via a double-headed coin? 1 in 1,000, right? 1 chance in 1,000 of pulling a double-headed coin, and if I do, we're finished. I'm guaranteed to get two heads. What are the chances of pulling a fair coin from my pocket? If 1 coin in 1,000 is double-headed and the rest are fair, what's the chance that when I pull a coin from my pocket, it's fair? What?
99.9%.
Right, 999 out of 1,000, exactly. What is the chance that I will pull a fair coin from my pocket and when I flip it twice, I'll get heads both times?
A fourth times.
Very good. 1 over 998 divided by 4. So we've got two alternative explanations for what we observed. One of them is I pulled a double-headed coin and got two heads. The other is I pulled a fair coin and happened to get lucky and got two heads. The probability of the first event is 1 in 1,000. The probability of the second event is about 0.2496. That's exactly 0.24975, which is what happens when you take 999 divided by 4, at least on my calculator. And which is about 1 over 250. So in fact, it's about 250 times more likely that one would get that result via a fair coin than the one would get that result with a double-headed coin. So we now actually have a basis for saying the odds are about 250 to 1, even after flipping it two times, that it's a fair coin. All right, that's what's called Bayesian statistics. We use something called Bayes' theorem, which I'm not going to go through. But that is a way of doing statistics which has the advantage that it actually tells you what you want to know, namely how likely something is, but the disadvantage that you have to have a prior probability. You have to know, you have to have probabilities going in, you then do an experiment, and you use the experimental results to modify those probabilities. All right, so you know, I don't want to go into a lot of this detail in this. This isn't a course in statistics, but it's worth your at least knowing that there is a way of thinking about these questions which does answer the kind of question you want. It's just that in order to do it, you need a, on some other basis, a prior probability going in probability. All right. Let's now discuss what's really the useful part for you, namely how to lie, because hopefully you're not in the business of lying, although it's been known to happen, but you are surely going to be in the business of detecting other people's lies. So one way of lying is to report only sampling errors if it was all error. Another way, which happens unintentionally as well as intentionally, is to report the confidence result, but to reverse its meaning. That what you're reporting is the chance of getting your result if the null hypothesis were true, and what you claim you're getting is the chance of the null hypothesis being true given that you got your result. Those are entirely different things, I think I've said. So therefore, you discover that if the firm is not discriminating against women, the chance that you would get the pattern of salaries we've gotten is only 1 in 20. That does not tell you that the odds are 19 out of 20 discriminating against women. It does tell you that the odds that it's discriminating against women are higher than they would have been if you hadn't gotten that result. But you'd have to have some prior estimate. If, for example, if you happened to know that the employment practices were such that it was impossible to discriminate against women, the firm is run by Martians and they can't tell men and women apart, say, or all wage decisions are made by a computer program, all of whose inputs are things that don't depend on your gender, then you would say, well, even with 1 in 20, it still isn't very likely. Third thing you can do, did I tell you people yet about how to make a fortune running an investment newsletter? Did I do that Thursday?
I did.
Yeah, right. This is basically the same basic approach. And the example the book gives is you hire 20 people to do test tastes of your new soft drink, which in fact is identical to your competitor's soft drink, though you don't tell them that. And when the 20 tell you the results in terms of how many random people preferred your drink to the competitors, you throw out the 19, which didn't get anything useful. You select the 1 in 20, which found that indeed most people preferred your drink to the competitor's drink, and you report on that. And you report with great pride that there's only one chance in 20 that you would have gotten this good a result by chance. All right? As the book points out, when you're looking at academic studies, this is going to happen even without trying. Because if you want to know whether electric power lines cause cancer, an article finding no evidence that they do is much less interesting than an article finding evidence that they do. It's less likely to get published. Sort of my favorite example of this, which I actually went over at one point in some detail, is that there is a figure on the probability of college women getting raped, which is commonly used in rape campaigns. And if you trace it back, it turns out that there are a whole bunch of people who did estimates. One of those estimates was wildly out of line with all the rest. That estimate was done by somebody who had a definition of rape sufficiently broad to include women who didn't think they had been raped, sufficiently broad to include women who had not been raped by the laws of the state where she did her study. She did a study on one college, I should say. That's the one that's always quoted. Why is it always quoted? Because the people who want to quote it are people who want to warn women about the danger of rape or want to warn colleges about the importance of preventing them, so they're going to pick the number that looks most striking. And that's going to be true in lots of other cases. I mean, that happens to be one that I've encountered on this campus when somebody was having a campaign. But as I say, the academic case is going to be sort of almost pervasive, that you're going to tend to get the more striking results heavily overrepresented. And then if you're a lawyer on either side and you're looking for results, what do you find? You find those results. In addition to what's happening accidentally, if you're an academic and you want to be published, the woman who did that study got a much better job after she had done that study than before because she was suddenly a national figure. So if you want to be published, you've got an incentive to try to find results. And even aside from that, if you're testing a theory you believe in, you have an incentive to find results. I mean, we all, in a sense, have an incentive to try to find things confirming our beliefs. And nowadays, there are even computer programs that will do it for you. It's what's called a specification search. It involves a situation where you think that A and B are related, but you're not sure of the details. You're not sure if B goes as A squared or as 1 over A, or you can think of a number of different ways they could be related, and you're not sure what else affects it, because after all, B could also be affected by a bunch of other features of whatever you're looking at. So you've got to think about how do we allow for other things. So you end up with 1,000 different ways you could test your theory. You pick the one that gives the best result, and you say, look, there's only one chance of 200 of getting this stronger result by chance. That's what's called specification search. So that's the third way of lying, as I say, intentionally or unintentionally, is to report a result that is selected because it's the result that gets the result you're looking for. Of course, you can also just lie. And I should suggest that as lawyers, you ought to watch out for that, that certainly in terms of public controversies, quite a lot of numbers that float around in public discussion are just invented numbers. I mean, the standard figure that one often sees for the number of homeless people, if you really trace it down, there are no data behind it. There are estimates the Census Department has made, but they're much less newsworthy estimates. And a fair number of other cases of that sort. Indeed, we know, statistics prove that, 95% of quota statistics are invented. All right, let me stop here for a minute, because I'm going to go on to what's really the next chapter, beginning of the next chapter. So are there questions at this point on what we've been doing? Yes?
I was wondering if you could explain a little more what the z-score is.
Sure.
The z-score
is the number of standard deviations away from above or below the mean that something is. So if we say your height is 2 standard deviations above the mean height for women, you'd look on a z-table to figure out what percentage of women have heights that are less than 2 standard deviations above the mean. And if it turned out it was 95%, you then conclude that you're in the top 5% of heights. That's all it is. But it's not always integers, of course. It might be that you're 2.3 standard deviations. And in fact, the z-table in there, you can look up if you're 2.36 standard deviations. It's got 2 decimal places on it. And if you wanted to know how likely it is that you're 23 standard deviations below, which would be more relevant to me, you would look for z equal minus 2.3 on the table. And in that case, since what the figure on the table is always showing is the probability of being that number or lower. So if I looked at minus 2.3, I would probably find a number like 0.03 or something, which is only about 3%. If I looked at plus point, whatever I said, I'd find a number like 97, meaning 97% below, 3% above. All right? And if you're doing a study where the question is not, is it above, but is it plausible that this is really the mean, then both things above and below count. And you then want to ask how likely is it that it's either 3 standard deviations above or 3 standard deviations below, which is twice as likely as the chance that it's 3 standard deviations above, because symmetrical graphs are equally likely to be upper tail or lower tail. Make sense?
Yeah.
But notice that the z-table is showing that specifically for a normal distribution. Or you wouldn't get the same results for all distributions. We had earlier Chebyshev's inequality, which basically says if you have a distribution set up to get as many people as possible far from the center, what's the most people you can have a standard deviation or 2 standard deviations or 3 standard deviations away? So that's sort of a limiting case. But for the normal distribution, the z-table gives you for everybody. And the other thing you have to remember in using it is that the standard deviation of the mean of a sample is the standard deviation of an individual observation divided by the square root of the size of the sample. Right. And that makes qualitative sense. It seems plausible that the average of the sample isn't going to vary as much as individual things vary. The fact is 1 over square root, you just have to remember it. I don't like things you just have to remember it. I prefer things you can work out for yourself, but that's one that I'm afraid is in that category. All right. Other questions from people? Right. So the stuff I want you to sort of take away is some understanding of what significance levels actually mean, and some understanding of the idea of estimating values, of finding probabilities or that kind of stuff, and an understanding of all of the ways in which statistics can be used to mislead people, because that's probably the most useful thing professionally for you, because I mean, if you're honest, you don't want to be misled, and if you're not honest, you also want to be able to mislead. I'm not going to offer any sermons on judicial ethics or, I guess, lawyer ethics, because that's doubtless somebody else's course, and it would be unethical for me to poach on someone else's territory. Let me go back. Sorry. So, multivariate statistics, we are thinking of a situation where something has two or more than two, I'm just taking the two case here, characteristics, and we're interested in the relations. So you have people, and the people have both height and age. You have states, and the states have both number of police per capita and crime rate. You can think of a whole lot of examples of that sort. And you're curious about the relationship between these two variables, or sometimes more than two, you're doing two at this stage. How are they related? And one way of answering it sort of visually is a scatter plot. All a scatter plot shows is that each point, the height is the value of one variable, the distance horizontally is the value of the other variable. And it turns out, in fact, that scatter plots can be considerably more informative than the statistical number, which is called a correlation coefficient. Because the correlation coefficient really only measures one thing, namely how close the relationship is to linear. But of course, there are lots of patterns other than linear. And one of the virtues of being a human being, probably other organisms as well, is that you have access to extraordinarily good pattern recognition software. That's turning it around. That's why it's turned out to be very, very hard to get computers to do some of the things that human beings do routinely. At this point, computers have gotten quite good at reading typed text. That even turned out to be a hard problem. They're very poor, well, not very poor, but they're not nearly as reliable at speech recognition as people are. I don't think they're as reliable at handwriting recognition as people are, even though we know that the computer is focusing all of its abilities on this single task, whereas you've got a whole life to live, and therefore using just a tiny bit of your processing power, as it were, when you're reading. So you might as well take advantage of it. If you look at those two graphs, what do you see in those two graphs?
You see scattered plots of points.
But what's the information? What's the pattern you're observing?
There's two parallel lines and there's two intersecting lines.
The first one looks as though it's roughly two parallel lines, and the second two intersecting lines. And you're not going to find out either of those from a correlation coefficient. That's why those are interesting examples. So the first one, you would get a positive correlation coefficient, because on the average, things that are farther to the right are higher. But you see what you would miss. You wouldn't see that it was really two lines parallel, each of them pretty closely correlated. On the second one, you wouldn't get any correlation at all. You'd get close to zero, even though you can see that they're very closely related. All right? The value of correlation coefficient, we'll come in a minute to the mathematical definition of it, which may or may not be confusing, but the value is from minus 1 to 1. Positive signs mean that one variable is big when the other variable is big, more precisely bigger than average when the other one is bigger than average. Negative 1, so that would be a line sloping up. Negative values mean that when one of them is big, the other tends to be smaller, so it's a line sloping down. And the magnitude of the correlation coefficient does not tell you how steep the slope is. It tells you how sure you are that the slope is there, how close it is to a straight line. So if you look at these two, which of those two do you think has the higher correlation coefficient? This one, call this one, or this one, which we'll call two?
Two
has a higher correlation coefficient, even though on two, one of the variables varies only very slowly with the other, on the other it looks like it varies quite a lot. And this is the same distinction that I made earlier about the distinction between statistical significance and the size of the effect. That on two, the result is very statistically significant, it's very close to a straight line, even though it doesn't look like a very large effect. All right. For those of you who aren't uncomfortable with math, the actual definition of the correlation coefficient is that for each value of the first variable, you calculate how many standard deviations it is from its mean and in which direction. You do the same thing for the second variable. And then for each observation, you multiply the figure for the first time to figure out for the second. So you then average over all observations, but for the same reason discussed before, you divide by n minus 1 instead of by n, because any correlation with a sample looks a little bit better than it ought to due to the fact that the mean is distorted in the same direction as the observations are distorted. All right. So if on the whole above, if high values of x occur with high values of y, then you'll have two positive numbers because everything is deviation from the mean, that'll be plus. If low values occur to low, that'll be two negative numbers, multiply them together, that's plus as well. So therefore, if the line is sloping that way, you're going to get a positive correlation coefficient. If it's sloping that way, the same argument says you're multiplying above average values of one with below average value of the other on each side, so you'll get a negative correlation coefficient. All right? So that's, again, this is not a precise argument for that. You need real statistics courses. Notice, however, that correlation need not be causation, and that's true for several different reasons. One of them is that you might have some third variable which is causing both of the ones you're looking at, and therefore they correlate. When the third variable is high, both of them are high. When the third variable is low, both of them are low, even though they have no effect on each other. So consider, what would you expect the correlation to be between the price of the car you drive and at what age you can be expected to die? It occurred to me I shouldn't have said life expectancy on the slide, because life expectancy is how much, you think it's zero. Life expectancy is how much longer you're going to live, and that might be a different result. So on the average, you think people who drive very cheap cars, on average, don't live any longer than or shorter than people who drive.
On average, there's no correlation.
You think so?
A little shorter.
So I think, yeah, if you have a nice car, you probably live longer.
If you have a nice car, that probably means you're rich. That probably means you can afford a good doctor. You don't have to go out in the cold and the rain to work in the, you know, pulling weeds in a field and so forth. So, now, I'm not sure that the life expectancy, which is going to be how much longer you have left to live, is going to correlate positively. Because what else do you think is likely to correlate with how good a car you have?
Your income.
We've already got, but I thought I heard something else.
Older people are more likely to be able to.
Very good. Older people are more likely to have expensive cars. Young people to have cheap cars. So even if the people with the expensive cars are going to die at a higher age, they're closer to that higher age already. So I don't actually know if their life expectancy is going to be higher or not. Right. Am I wrong
that's
about life expectancy? That's probably the wrong term, but I'm not sure what the right term is. But yes, I'm just distinguishing years remaining and expected age of death. Mm-hmm. The same thing. Do you agree that the number of children one has born is probably negatively correlated with the height of adults? Why? What?
People are taller in fertile countries because of lack of or good nutrition.
You're perhaps being much too fancy.
Say yes again.
What characteristic guarantees that you have born no children?
Your attractiveness to the other.
Looking around this room. Born children. What characteristic guarantees that you have born no children?
You're male.
Very good. Right? There's only one person in this room who could have born any children. Women on average are shorter than men. Therefore, there's going to be a correlation, a negative correlation between height and how many children you've born. Now, your fancier version about countries might also be true, but mine is a much simpler argument. But it's not because being short makes you likely to have children. Right? I try to use words carefully, and I did say born for a reason. But it's also the case that you might have causation. First, you have to know which direction the causation is going, and you might have you might have a real relationship where A causes B, but where C also causes B and stops A, as it were, in which case that could wipe it out. So to take the case, which is sort of a politically relevant one, people occasionally point out that on average, if you look at states, states with the death penalty have higher murder rates than states without the death penalty. I don't swear that's true, but I think it is, and it used to be true at least. What?
I've read that.
Yeah. And that sounds as though it means that the death penalty tends to increase the murder rate, which, you know, you, with a little effort, think of reasons for that. But what's the other obvious explanation? I've got it here, basically.
There's a lot of violent crime connected
to death penalty. The two other, the most likely one, it seems to me, is that high murder rates create political pressure for death penalties. And the another possible one is that there are some social, cultural, whatever factors that make people more willing to kill other people, or perhaps in some societies make people very unwilling to kill other people. If you're pro-death penalty, you could say, well, there are states where everybody's a wimp. And wimps, when their voters vote against the death penalty. And wimps, when their criminals wimp out at the point when they're about to kill the victim and say, all right, I'll let you go. This time. Just don't. But have more money. What?
Just wound.
Death threat. Yeah. So, but my point is only that you could easily enough imagine different cases, and you then have the much harder problem of how do you really answer it. And that particular one, the death penalty and murder rates, as you may know, has been one of the big controversies where most of the public discussion consists of somebody on one side of it picking whatever scientific studies he thinks supports him and only quoting those, but where the serious statisticians have really disagreed on what the right conclusion is for a long time. And you might have a case where there really is causation, but it doesn't cause a correlation. Right? Not only does correlation not imply causation, right? Both of those cases look like there's causation of some sort. We don't know for sure, but right? It sure looks as though the, I don't know, what's a likely, I suppose, the one on the left, the characteristic on the left is your chance of stumbling, and the characteristic along on the horizontal is your age. So small children can't walk very well, then they get to be adults and they can walk pretty well, and then they get old and feeble and start stumbling again. All right? So that's a direct causal relationship, but it gives zero correlation because it's not a linear relationship. Does everybody know the riddle of the Sphinx? What's the riddle of the Sphinx?
It walks on fours in the morning, on two legs in the middle of the day.
What animal walks on fours in the morning, on two legs in the middle of the day,
and on three?
And on three in the evening. Anybody, everybody know the answer to that? Humans, right, exactly. So, right?
I heard that actually at an impulsive banquet, which is retarded to remember. But.
Right. Yes, no, it's somewhere in classical antiquity as the riddle of the Sphinx, and I don't remember exactly where it is. But, and the other one, it also looks as though there's a causation. What would be your guess about what's going on the one on the right?
Two different effects, or two different populations.
You have people who differ in some third way that's not shown on the graph. All right? Maybe they're Americans and Englishmen, or men and women, or native-born and immigrants. You could think of lots of different things, but there's some binary division such that for people with one characteristic, there's a positive relation, and for the other one, a negative relation between the same thing. All right.
But either of those, it doesn't actually mean there's a causation.
It doesn't guarantee there's a causation. But my only point is those could easily enough reflect causations and yet would not show up in a correlation.
There could be a correlation to a different distribution as in the first.
Of course, just as before. My point is only that not only can you have correlation without causation, you can also have causation without correlation. Because a causation could create any of these things. You can use correlation to predict if you, for example, if a state has a high death penalty, it probably has a high murder rate. That doesn't depend on whether it's the death penalty causing the murder rate or the murder rate causing the death penalty. On the other hand, if you have the causality wrong, then a prediction that you were making partly on the basis of that might be wrong. For example, taller adults are less likely to have born children than shorter, but taller females aren't less likely to have born children than smaller. indeed, taller females are more likely to have born children than smaller, because some of the smaller ones are 6 years old. Right? That's why I switched from adults, by the way. And you might also get the policy wrong. Dying correlates with being in the hospital. So what's the obvious policy order to make sure you don't die?
Stay
away from the hospital, right? And similarly, if you found out that the death penalty correlated positively with murder rate, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you want to get the murder rate down, you should abolish the death penalty. For that, you'd have to figure out what the actual causation was, not just the correlation. All right, we now have a fancier version of this analysis, which is called a linear regression. We'll later be doing regressions that are more elaborate. And what a regression is doing is not, the correlation coefficient in effect tells you how nearly are the points on a straight line. The linear regression is an attempt to estimate the straight line they are on. And that gets us back to measuring sizes of effects as well as significant. So if you do a linear regression, what are you doing? You're graphing the line y equals a plus bx. A is the intercept. A is when x is 0, then y is a. Does that make sense? So therefore, that's where the line hits the axis. And b is the slope. It shows each time x goes up by 1, how much does y go up by. All right? So now we're actually getting to measures of the size of the effect, because if we had a really high correlation coefficient, but the coefficient b was really low, we would say, all right, they sure are related, but the relationship doesn't really matter. It has almost no effect. Whereas if we had a not so high correlation coefficient, but it, suppose the variables are eating fish and getting cancer. And if it turned out that there was a really high correlation coefficient, what the correlation coefficient said was that each ton of fish you ate increased your chance of getting cancer by 1 in 1,000,000, that wouldn't be very interesting. Whereas if we had a not very high correlation coefficient, but a big slope, if what it said was, we're not sure there's a relationship, but our best estimate is that every fish you eat increases your chance of cancer by 1%, that we would be worried about and would want to do some more research on it. The equivalent of the correlation coefficient, in fact, is actually related to it, is something that's called R-squared, and R-squared is the standard measure reported for a linear regression, saying how closely does the line fit the points. So what you're doing is saying the very simplest prediction, if we didn't have the line, is just to put all values of y at their average value. And we want to know how much better than that we can do by having a straight line mapped to it instead. So what you do is you take the total sum of squares, which is the sum of squared deviations from the average for your y values, minus the sum of squared residual, where the residual is the distance of y from the corresponding point on the line. So if I go back here, if I look here, the value, the one figure is how far is y from the average value of y, and that's big for this, negative for this. A different one is how far from is y from the prediction of the regression, and that's how much above or below the line it is. All right. So if the points are very close to being on a line, then on average they'll be much closer to the line than they are to their average. On the other hand, if it's almost random, then the line won't do much better job of predicting where they are than just saying everyone has this average value. Make sense? So then this is math, which you probably don't want to. You like it fine, but the basic idea is that you're comparing the sum of squared deviations from the average with the sum of squared deviations from the residual from the regression line, and you end up with something called R squared, and R squared tells you how much of the variance about the mean is explained by the regression line. So an R squared of 1 would mean the points were exactly on the line, so that all of the deviation of each point from the average value of all the points was explained by the other variable. So if we observed, for example, suppose we were measuring height against age, and suppose, contrary to reality, that everybody grew at, 6 inches a year forever, or for as long as our sample went. We would then say, well, the average height of our population is 4 feet. The average deviation from that height is 2 feet. But if we plot a line where you predict height from age, the average deviation from that is zero. So all of the deviation from the average height is explained by our regression line. Does that make sense? And more plausibly, some of it is. And the R squared means that the regression explains all of the variance. R squared is zero means it explains none of the variance. R squared can't be negative because it's a square. And in fact, it's the square of the correlation coefficient, which we went to earlier. So R squared is then a measure of how good the fit is, and B, of how strong the relationship is. One way in which you can look for patterns is by plotting residuals. The residual is the amount by which the regression misses the point. So if I go back a little over here, can you see the cursor on the screen? Is it? Yeah. This one has a residual that's a small positive. This is a smaller, sorry, the cursor just vanished. That's a smaller negative one. There the residual is about zero and so forth. You can imagine doing a graph in which instead of graphing the points, you graph the residuals. And that would give you some information about how, about the part of the variation that wasn't explained by the line. So suppose, for example, it turned out when you graphed the residuals that you got something that went up, then down, then up, then down. That would look, that's very interesting, especially when you discover that the horizontal variable is the date. And that therefore what's really going on is a cycle associated with the seasons, which is messing up what's an otherwise linear relationship. All right, imagine we're looking at the height of trees. We've planted a forest and we're going to watch the height of the trees for the next 50 years. And the first observation is that's a roughly linear, it just keeps growing. But that's funny because we keep having this repeated cycle where first it grows a bit less than we expected, and then a bit more, and then a bit less, and then a bit more. It's growing less in the winter and more in the summer. So by plotting the residual, by seeing the part not explained, you may see additional patterns, which will then help you figure out what's going on. All right? There's a kind of statistics which is not what people are mostly taught, but which is actually quite useful, which is called exploratory statistics. The statistics you usually learn from most kinds of, you know, economics and other fields is the stuff we've been talking about in which you get confidence intervals and regression results and so forth, almost all of which assumes that you start out knowing what you think the relationship is and you're just testing your conjectures. What exploratory statistics is about is trying to use the human pattern recognition ability to figure out what the pattern is without knowing in advance. And there are programs, not as common, designed to do it. There's one old one at Price Looks, it's called Datadesk. And Datadesk.
Okay.
And the way you what you do with that program is you look at the data in different ways. So that you can say, all right, well, we've got 15 different characteristics for these people. One of them is male or female. All right, let's color all the male points red and all the female points blue. Does any pattern, looking at the, and then let's plot a two-dimensional scatter plot, or a three-dimensional scatter plot. You can do that and look around it. Do we see any patterns coming out? How about some other things? What if we plot people below 20 in one color and above 20? No, there are lots of other things. I'm just giving one of the examples. The reason I have a copy of Datadesk, which I haven't used for many years, is that many, 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 many years ago, my sister was at some kind of a computer show where they were demoing Datadesk. And she told the people who were doing it that her father was, among other things, a statistician, which he is, was, and that they ought to send him a copy to see if he could get a blurb. And they sent my father a copy, and they sent her a copy, and she had no use, so she gave it to me. But my father's comment on Datadesk was that it was the first statistics program he had seen with which somebody untrained in statistics would do more good than harm. Because, of course, if you don't know what you're doing, it's pretty easy to use the program to generate what look like impressive results, whatever you want to see. Whereas this one, rather than doing that, was designed to actually learn something, to find just lots of different ways of looking at your data that might expose the package. The book's example discusses Mary Starchway, who is the head of the company, and she is both an outlier and an influential observation. She's an outlier, meaning that, let's go back to this, a point up here would be an outlier. It's way, in both directions, way off where everybody else is. It's also an influential observation, meaning that the graph would change quite a lot if you took it out. Do those have to be the same thing? Does the fact that she's an outlier mean she would both had more experience and had a much higher salary? Does the fact she's an outlier necessarily mean that point has a large effect on the line?
Not necessarily.
For example, where would you?
Let's take this one.
If you extended it onto the whiteboard, it wouldn't matter.
That's right. Suppose we've got an outlier right here, which is right on the extension of the line, so it's not affecting where the line is at all, even though it's way out. On the other hand, if we had something up here, that would have a big effect, because trying to get close to that, you have to distort the line a good deal.
On the line, she can still be an outlier.
Yeah, sure. Because if she's on the line, far from the line, it's far from the rest of the data points.
Okay. That's an outlier, even if you believe this is a relevant line.
Right.
If you were graphing height and income, basketball stars would be outliers. So I just went through earlier the limitations. It's the same point I was making earlier with the correlation coefficient, that you might have close relationships that aren't linear, as in the two examples we looked at before. And there are ways in which you might deal with those, one of which is by using nonlinear regressions. So that for the first one, you say, clearly Y is depending on X, but it's not linear. Let's try Y equals A plus BX plus CX squared. And then B is negative because we observe that initially, if you think about it, the X squared terms get more and more important as X gets bigger. So initially, the negative B means that Y goes down with X. For some reason, my cursor has been vanishing. All right. And as X gets bigger and the X squared term becomes more important role for the X term, eventually makes it go up again. All right? The second case, as we've discussed before, suggests that there's a third variable we're missing. And if we could find that third variable, we could then do a separate, probably a binary variable. It looks as though it's just two different groups. So we could do it separately for men and women, or separately for children and adults, or for native-born and immigrants, or whatever, Republicans and Democrats, whatever. Yeah, that could be. You could easily imagine a pattern like that if what you're looking at is, you know, how does your confidence in the administration's policy vary with the number of times you've heard Obama speak? And I could easily imagine that the answer might be it goes up for Democrats and down for Republicans, right? Or something like that. So then you just do your linear regression separately for Republicans and Democrats, and suddenly the pattern appears. Now, what we'll be talking about much more Thursday, but start on now, is the idea of a multiple regression. And a multiple regression is one where you think that there's a relationship but involves more than two variables. I'm just describing a very simple example of that. So suppose you are looking for the death penalty effects on the murder rate, and you say, look, one of the weird features about the human race is that human males go crazy at about age 16 or 17 and recover at about age 26. And we've got very clear evidence for that. Just look at insurance rates. There are a reason why young adult males have higher insurance rates than either young adult females or old adult males. It turns out the same thing shows up if you look at crime rates. I think I can offer evolutionary biological explanations for this odd pattern of behavior that happens associated with the general evolutionary biological explanation for why men and women have different behavioral patterns, because they play different roles in reproduction, and evolution tells us that reproduction is what we're basically designed to do successfully, and if we have different roles, then we...
If you believe in life, that's, you know what I mean?
No, if you believe in Darwin.
Oh, okay.
Right? That is what Darwin tells us. It's not a matter of believing in life. You wouldn't be here if your parents had succeeded in reproducing. They wouldn't be there if their parents hadn't succeeded.
They're extraordinarily successful.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, that we don't require for you to be here. But that means, but the fact that your parents were extraordinarily successful means that there are more people like you in the population.
Okay.
Right. But in any case, the basic point is that, in fact, empirically, fraction of the population that is young adult males is one of the things that predicts murder rates. Unemployment rates, I think, also predict murder rates, and there are a variety of other variables that do. So you say, well, if we want to figure out how the death penalty affects it, we somehow want to make allowance for all the other things that are affecting it, because it might turn out that states with the death penalty are also states with young populations, or also states with high unemployment or something. We want to control for that. So the way you do it with a multiple regression is that you write an equation such as the murder rate equals a constant A. You don't know the value of these numbers. You're going to find out what they are. Plus the second constant times 1 if there's a death penalty and 0 if there isn't, plus a third constant times the fraction of the population that's young adult males, plus a fourth constant times the unemployment rate. And that's one very simple set of relationships suggesting that it depends on all these things. And you might be looking at all states in a single year. You might be looking at one state over time. You might be pooling both. You might have 50 states over 30 years or something. You can imagine lots of ways you could do this, and there are lots of other complications that could come in, because the murder rate might also be affected by whether there was a death penalty last year, for example, which might affect people and so forth. But what you're doing with a multiple regression, well, let's not get to the more complicated versions yet, because we're almost out of time. What you're doing with a multiple regression is just as we were doing with the linear or simple linear regression. You're saying, what are the values of A, B1, B2, and B3 that get the best fit? So if you say, all right, if we predict murder rate is determined in this way, how can we adjust those parameters in the way that comes closest to fitting our actual data on murder rate by state? And when we've done that, if it turns out that B3 is positive, that'll tell us, that'll be at least evidence, that high unemployment tends to raise the murder rate. If it turns out that B2 is positive, that will confirm our suspicion that a high fraction of young adult males tends to raise the murder rate. How about if B1 is positive?
Tells us the fraction of the state population is male?
No. F was the fraction of the state population is male. B1 is the coefficient that's multiplying the variable that tells us whether or not there's a death penalty. D is 1 if there's a death penalty, 0 if there isn't. So if B1 is positive, what does that tell us about the relationship between death penalty and the murder rate?
Probability
that
the murder rate,
the
death penalty, that if that increases, then the murder rate increases.
That tells us, that would be evidence that having the death penalty increases the murder rate. If B1 were negative, that would be evidence that it decreases the murder rate. All right? Now, the real studies of this sort are much more elaborate than this, of course, but the basic idea is you're trying as best you can to fit the dependent variable, which is the murder rate, to a bunch of independent variables, and finding the coefficients that come give you the closest fit. And then each of those coefficients gives you an estimate of what the relationship is, and then there are other measures that are like significance measures that tell you how likely this is to be chance or how likely it is to be significant. Make sense? Doesn't make sense?
Wait, I don't understand. What's B1? How do you get the figure for B1?
You get the figure for B1 by trying all possible values of A, B1, B2, and B3 until you find the set of numbers that gives you the closest fit. There's really a fancier mathematical way of doing it, but that's what it amounts to. What you're saying is, if you had just A plus B2F, we'd be back with our linear regression. That would be just... And in that case, how do you do it? You try all values of A and B2 until you get the ones that give you the closest fit to the data, what we were doing before. And this is just the same thing with more dimensions, because it's a line being driven, drawn, in this case, in a four-dimensional space, because you've got three independent variables and one dependent variable. What?
One dependent in matrices. You do it by hand.
That is, you can solve the problem by inverting a matrix.
Yeah, for the one, I don't know about multiple.
Oh, for the multiple one also. Oh, yeah, sure. No, I say you don't really have to try all possible numbers, but
yeah,
conceptually
yeah.
That's what you're doing. Conceptually you're saying, let me find the set of coefficients which gets this as close to a correct prediction.
Yeah, there's an analytic solution. Yeah,
of course.
Problem.
Sure, yeah. You can do it in a single line of APL.
Yeah, sure.
APL is a programming language not much used nowadays, which somebody described as the world's only write-only programming language. Because it's this amazingly compact language in which you're really clever. You can do all sorts of complicated things in one line, but you're never going to be able to figure out what you did when you're finished. But anyway.
MATLAB.
What?
MATLAB.
Yeah, that I haven't used. But APL is fun. I haven't used it for a long, long time. But APL is a language where matrix operations are primitives. So that multiplying by a matrix is like multiplying by a number.
Yeah,
so, what?
MATLAB.
Is it? Yeah. Well, it may be derived from it. I don't know.
Could very well
APL is pretty old. Remember that there is a homework assignment on the syllabus which is not to be handed in but which is to be done so that we can discuss it Thursday. All right. The syllabus is on the webpage, naturally. Thank you.